Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about use after free vulnerabilities. And these were cases where a program had some pointers to some data structure and it tried to free that data structure. Presumably it was looking at one pointer and said, oh, I want to get rid of this thing. So it freed the data structure, cleared that pointer. But problematically, there was another way the program could still access that freed memory. And the malloc or new implementation would say, okay, well, you freed up this memory, let me use that for something else. And we'd allocate some purportedly unrelated pointer, object rather, and we'd have a pointer that goes to the same memory, which now the program is confused. It thinks that it contains object A and object B at the same time. And the attacker can take advantage of this to manipulate the contents of object A and object B in ways that the program is not built to do. So one example of how this could come up is that it's an information leak that you can, that if you know the program outputs what's in object A at some point, you can use that to read object B. Another example is that can often lead to code execution. So if we have some sort of subclass where we need to look up what method do we call, well, the program is going to say, okay, well, if I want to call a method on object A, I figure out where that method is by looking in its V table, find a pointer to the code for that method, and it could say, I know where the code is, even though maybe this pointer wasn't set as we usually would set it by making an object A, but because of what object B was doing. That was use after free vulnerabilities. And I mentioned that these are sort of very pervasive as far as sort of modern exploits, because, well, it's kind of easier to deal with things that where we're concerned about bounds checking. It's kind of straightforward to know, oh, I have an array, I should stay within it. And these vulnerabilities don't have that sort of pattern. What we're looking for is this case where we have two pointers to something and we don't realize that as we're deleting one. And that's a much bigger change to how we would write code in C or C++ to keep that from happening. Now, we're going to continue looking today at the issue of, well, you know, except for use after free vulnerabilities, most of the issues we were dealing with as far as these memory mismanagement exploits were about going out of bounds of something. And that the problem was that we weren't doing bounds checking, that the program would do array of I without knowing whether I is in bounds or not. And the attacker could take advantage of this to end up writing to memory they're not supposed to. And, you know, this is something that it seems like we should be able to systematically fix. And we're going to talk about that in detail today. And I started by mentioning some sort of less systematic fixes. So one thing is that the compilers have realized that in some common cases, they can do this checking for you. And one case where they do that is some library functions. So like if you call memcopy, which is meant to copy a fixed amount of data, the compiler can realize, oh, you're calling this with a particular size, but also I know how big the buffer you're copying into is. Let's also pass that and check that. And so in GCC, there's these special check versions, which the compilers use when they can figure out what the size of the buffer that you're, you know, mem copying into or some various other operations, string copy, string cat, and so on. And this works great when the compilers can find the size easily. So it deals with sort of most of the simple examples of buffer overflow we showed where, you know, we were just calling something like get s on an array of a known size, but it doesn't work so well when that information isn't easily available. Like if we have a function which is just getting a pointer in, and it's not obvious to, you know, at least to the compiler, what the size of that, the thing that pointer points to is. And in that case, the compiler doesn't really have a fallback. So, you know, it's just going to silently not prevent those buffer overflows. So the question is, do the check versions support bounce checking on arrays where the size is determined at runtime? So my recollection is that most of the check versions take the argument, so take at the size as an argument. So it could be determined at runtime in the sense of being put into that argument at runtime, but the compiler would still sort of need to do the analysis to, you know, compute what that size is, which it's only going to be able to do in certain special cases. And the big issue is that if I have a, you know, say a read into buffer function that takes, you know, a char star p, and I do a mem copy, you know, into p of something, the compiler, you know, it can't write code that, you know, figures out what's the potential size of p for this function. And it can't do that even if maybe it would be obvious to us. Maybe if there's like a size argument, the compiler can't verify, you know, that that's what that argument is used for. Okay. So we mentioned that there are these sort of implicitly called check versions, and well, that's fine for when the compiler is doing this magic trick for us, but we really want to write our code to actually check these sizes by hand, to not rely on the compiler being able to figure out what the bounds are, since it can't always do that. You know, in some cases, for quite good reason, it's just the information is just not in the code. We want to add it. And part of this is that, well, you know, instead of using a function like some functions like string copy and things like that, which basically don't have a way of checking sizes, we like have to do something in advance. It seems like, oh, well, you just figure out the size and you pass it to these special variants of the function. And in some cases, this works great. So snprintf is an example where we don't have the problem we mentioned with string copy and string cat. In snprintf, we pass the size of the buffer. You know, it does kind of what you expect. It stays within that size, just truncating the string you get. Snprintf is the, you know, sized version of sprintf, which is the print-to-string version of printf. But then we have these functions, string and copy, string and cat, where I would say the C library authors made a mistake. They said, oh, we want to specify a size to limit how much we copy, and we want to specify a size to limit how much we concatenate. And that's a useful piece of functionality, but it doesn't match with sort of our bounds checking idea that limiting the size to copy, well, you actually wanted to still have a null terminated string at the end of it most of the time. And this end actually doesn't include that null terminator. It's the limit, you know, where it doesn't write the null terminator if we hit the limit too early. For string ncat, it said, well, this is the number of characters you want to concatenate. That's a useful function, but it doesn't help really make it easy for us to enforce that we don't make the destination string get too big. So next I'm going to finish up looking at sort of these two unfortunate functions that, you know, try to help us do manual bounds checking when the compiler can't do it for us, and then talk about some sort of more general bounds checking ideas. So questions before I move on? So the question is, why didn't they just change the string copy function? So I believe the sort of notion of the sort of intended use of string and copy is that you'd have some buffer you know, of say size, and you'd string and copy into that buffer. And then when you were like printing it out, you would do something like print out with a format that specifies the maximum size you'd expect. I think that's sort of the use case they had in mind, where string and copy not null terminating wouldn't be an issue because everywhere else you use the string, you'd also specify a maximum size. So I believe that's why they felt this non-null terminating string and copy was useful. Okay. So, mention those string and copy. So, as you might imagine, some people have discovered that, you know, maybe programmers would like better versions of these. Unfortunately, none of these are standardized, so they're not portable. But FreeBSD, which is a Unix-like OS and Linux via a library called libbsd, has these functions stringlcopy and stringlcat, which are basically like what you probably would have thought thinking about bounds checking, string and copy, and string and cat were. And Windows has very similar functions called string copy underscore s and string cat underscore s. So people have done this, but none of these are standardized. And often in a large software project, they'll just write their own version if they want one. So that's sort of bounds checking C library functions. Now, the C++ library is kind of better about this. So C++, for example, vectors are dynamic array class. And it has this dot at operation, which acts like the square brackets, but it does bounds checking. That if you have a vector of size 50 and you dot at 60, this throws an exception. If you don't catch that exception, your program terminates with, you know, some kind of readable message. But the normal version here, or the square brackets version, doesn't do that check, and instead it's undefined behavior. This is like probably overflows a heap buffer. So this sort of thing is probably exploitable if this isn't a program that we're concerned about. And you might say, so why do they bother having this? Well, they're concerned about performance. That they want, C++ really cares about giving programmers the option of doing things that have low overhead, so they wanted to have this bounds checking version of this, even though that's dangerous. And you could say that maybe that was a mistake, but at the least, the bounds checking version's easy to get at, and this sort of does what we expect. And thinking of, well, we can provide these sort of interfaces where, you know, when we go out of bounds, we just get an exception, you know, can't we just make it so this happens all the time? And for example, you might imagine maybe we could just make this version, this operator here, do the same thing as at. That's an easy change, and it's even a change that we can make legally. This is undefined behavior. Undefined means the standard doesn't care if you make it throw an exception instead. So you could absolutely just make it always bounds check for vectors. And, well, if you want, for example, standard, most common Linux C++ library to do it, if you pass the option glibcxx underscore debug, it will do that. It will always bounds check. And you might say, well, you know, if we can, you know, add this sort of bounds checking, you know, can we just do this everywhere? If we think about sort of other programming languages, like if you think of Python, for example, in Python, it's just not possible to go out of bounds and have it cause weird behavior. And well, if Python can do it, can we just extend C in the same way? And the answer is, well, yes, but and we're going to look at how that might look. How would we add bounds checking to C? And probably a big observation you can make is that though there's been a lot of proposals to do it, including some many which have been implemented, you probably have never used a bounds checking version of C. You probably never had easy access to one. So the question is, what's going on? And that's something we should think about. And then we're going to look at sort of, you know, why that's happening when we look at what we have to do to add bounds checking. So one sort of example of what bounds checking might look like, I probably should call this fail if instead of check to be clear, is that, you know, if we take our vulnerable function that reads into a buffer, we want to check this value of I every time before it's used and fail if it's, you know, out of range. Okay. So, you know, this is something we want the compiler to do this. And this is actually something that we can pretty easily let the compiler do. The compiler can just have this rule that every time we see buffer of I, we do this sort of fail if check here before that runs. And that's pretty simple to implement. Now, where we get into problems is if we want to extend that same idea to a case where, I didn't remove that line. Where the buffer comes from outside of the function. So, you know, here, well, we don't actually know how big buffer is. And that means when we want to add this check, we can tell we need to add a check here. We can tell this needs some sort of check, but we don't know what, you know, the sort of range that's acceptable is. Probably this should be. Should be I++ for obvious reasons. I'll edit this slide later, but this should be I+= 1 at the end of this to make any sense. But we want to add this bounds check here before this access to buffer I, but we don't know these bounds here. So how do we fix that? So we can fix that, but it's kind of going to be a big change. And this sort of how big this change is going to be is going to show sort of why, you know, it's been hard to, you know, sort of just add bounds checking to C. So if we want to know what these bounds are, we need to have these passed in. These need to be passed into this function. And so this immediately makes this idea of adding bounds checking to C very problematic from a backwards compatibility point of view, that, well, now we need to change how functions are called because we need to somehow pass this information. We need to have some way of storing this information elsewhere and looking it up. And either of those are going to be, you know, complicated and seem like they might add a lot of overhead. But let's start with the simple idea of doing the most straightforward thing, way to pass these two pieces of information into this function. And what I'm going to do for that is I'm going to, instead of representing pointers as a single value, I'm going to represent them as this sort of triple of values where I have the actual pointer, you know, what we previously pass in. And along with every pointer, I'm going to pass in the beginning and end of the thing it points to. So if we have a buffer and this pointer points to the middle of the buffer, we're going to also have, so pointer dot pointer. We're also going to have the minimum and maximum tell us the range of things that are also in this buffer. And this is something that the compiler could potentially figure out how to generate for us. So now when I have a buffer and I make a pointer to the middle of it, the compiler needs to actually make that sort of set three pointers in this struct. So questions about this sort of this fat pointer representation?
Is there a reason why we have three pointers as opposed to just having a pointer to where the start of the buffer is and saying only go X number of bytes?
So another representation we could have chosen, yes. So you're is that we could have done, you know, why is thank you for tablet. Is we could have done like char star base and like a size. Yes. And that would give the same information as this minimum and maximum. I think regardless of what we do, we're going to need to have sort of two extra values. Because we need to know what's how much before our value and how much after we need. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But indeed, some other representation might be a bit more compact because... You know, maybe we could store this in, you know, the size in 4 bytes or something like that. Okay. So the question is, why do we need a before and after? So if we look in this example here, I'm getting a pointer to the middle of the buffer, and this is a thing I'm allowed to do, and we need to handle that case. And the existing C code I need to be compatible with can do something like P of minus one, you know, equals X, for example. And we need to know that this is in bounds. That answer that question? Okay, so given this sort of fat pointer representation, it's straightforward for the compiler to sort of generate automatic checks for are we going staying in bounds or not. So in this case, here's my string copy implementation where I copy until a null character. Oh, I missed the order of this. Wow. So this is meant to be the other way around for obvious reasons. But we go from dest to source. From source to dest, not dest to source. But before each access, we check, you know, is this index we're computing, you know, inside the maximum and minimum for source and dest. We also do it before this condition on the while loop. And this is checks that we can insert automatically. But this illustrates sort of the other reason why adding bounds checking to C is just sort of not really a slam dunk, is that we took what was just like three relatively simple lines of C code and added a whole lot of stuff to it to implement this bounds checking. So that's a real concern. So like we have these two comparisons for every pointer accessed and three times as much space for every pointer. And that's a huge amount of overhead. And that makes it really hard to convince people that this is a good idea for my C program. Now, many of you observe that, you know, maybe you could get rid of the minimum by saying we always do indexing from zero. That's indeed you know, an option we have. But that gets into a bigger issue that people have with these proposals to add bounds checking to C, which is that it doesn't seem very useful if we can't just run all the existing code with it. That people really want to be able to take their existing C programs and run them as is. And when we think about running existing C programs, this gets us into more trouble. Because C programmers do things that you would probably think shouldn't happen that are going to cause problems for this approach I showed so far. So one example of things that C programmers do here is having variable length structs. So here we have a struct where, according to what's declared here, we have a link count. I probably should draw this. So we have 4 bytes here. We have a link count and a string, which is 1 byte. But that's not actually how this program uses it. What it actually does is it allocates an extra length bytes. With the intention that this string is not actually 1 byte, but takes up all that space and has a null terminator. So this is basically a way of allocating space for this link count variable and a string all at once. And this is a pattern which is surprisingly common. This is not the only place you can find it, but I just wanted to point to a, you know, real program you might care about securing. So this is a network server. Now that's some ancient code written probably in the 90s sometime that uses this pattern where if we did our straightforward thing, we'd say, oh, you did s.string. Well, the minimum and maximum are here, but that's not actually what should happen. So if we wanted to support this pattern, we need some way of, you know, of dealing with knowing that there's this extra space and figuring out that the extra space is for the string variable and that, no, it's really okay if we go beyond the bounds of this array into that space, but not beyond what was malloced. So that's an inconvenience that makes this harder in practice than we'd like. There's some more. So Perl used to be a programming language that was more popular than Python, no longer the case. But here is the source code, the C source code that implements Perl. So part of Perl, they have this pointer here to a mypool t, whatever that is. And they have this macro in the Perl code called pointer to uv. And you might say, well, this is probably pointer, spelled ptr. What is a UV? It's an unsigned int value. So they convert a pointer to an unsigned int and then pull it out later. And they're doing this to stash a pointer in a normal Perl variable that just holds an int. Just because they're using an API that can store a normal Perl variable in this internal Perl source code. But that means that they expect to be able to fit a pointer and any related bounds information inside an int. And we would like to break that by making pointers take up more space than an int. So we somehow, you know, if we want to support this code, we need to make that work. Another example of horrible, maybe this is less one of the less horrible ones, but things other C programmers do is that, well, C, as you may know, doesn't have classes and inheritance, but you can kind of fake it. And this is actually guaranteed to work in a strong sense. So we can have a subclass struct that contains a copy of the superclass, we can get a pointer to that superclass and then cast it back to the subclass, which we know works because the superclass is at the beginning of the subclass. And this is something you will find some C programmers doing who, you know, don't like to write C++. Especially historically, it used to be that C++ compilers were much harder to come by. So you might see code written in this way to kind of get inheritance without actually having sort of full-fledged C++ features, where they expect to be able to take this superclass pointer and convert it to something bigger. So it's tricky to figure out how do we make the bounds information that we might have work in this kind of environment. So these are sort of our, you know, some examples of hard cases. Now, despite all this, there have been sort of, as I said, real implementations that sort of added this kind of bounds checking to C. And sort of an example from 2002, way back, is something called Secure, was research paper on this. And they had a particular approach to try to address some of the issues we just talked about. So one of the issues we talked about was that the overhead was really high. And a big part of why the overhead was so high is that I was proposing replacing all pointers with these, you know, triples of different types of pointers. And you can observe that most of the time we don't actually need to do that, because if we think of, for example, this pointer here, we're never going to use this as an array. So their observation was, we can have actually a different kind of pointer for that versus one that might point to an array, and we can try to look at the code or annotate it, have someone go through the code and add little bits to mark pointers as this is used for an array versus isn't, so we can make that change and not have to replace every single pointer usage with, you know, this fat pointer representation when we know most of the time we're never going to do array indexing. They also need to handle this sort of typecasting situation that we convert a pointer to a different type of pointer. So they had a type of pointer which kept track of extra information about what it was pointing to support that as one of the other types. And so they implemented this. They tested it on a variety of benchmarks that people at the time believed were good for measuring CPU performance. And the overhead varied tremendously between programs. So sometimes, essentially, the program wasn't hurt at all, and probably the reason for that is that the compiler, once it had all this code with these fat pointers and all the bounds checks, could basically either eliminate all the bounds checks or the ones that were left over were not a big deal. But in cases where that didn't happen, they had very high overhead. So it was, more than twice as long to run. And that's a hard thing to convince people to use, you know. So, you know, you might say, like, security incidents are really bad, but telling someone, we can make sure your web server doesn't have this kind of security flaw, but not all security flaws. It might still have some others. And it's going to run at half the speed. That's probably not a proposition that's going to win many people over, even though if it maybe should. And what's worse is that this is after doing some work to annotate the code. Like, it wasn't actually just recompile. There was a little bit of extra work to change things. And this is especially necessary to deal with the issue of library calls. That the library calls, well, if you're calling a library, if you don't want to recompile that library too, you need to sort of also annotate the library calls to do bounds checking there and like convert to back to normal pointers. So the question is, don't we have to do bounds checking sometimes anyways? Why would the runtime matter? So this time, this 2.5x time overhead was overhead running a program that was known not to, well, was basically known not to have any cases where where it actually went out of bounds. All the bounds checks always worked. There wasn't actually a bug that they were fixing in that program. That was just the cost of running a program that didn't have buffer overflows with the extra bounds checking that they had to add. So it's true that if we're thinking about overhead, some of the overhead is kind of things that we shouldn't think of as real overhead because they're checks we should be doing anyways. But these checks, these were on programs where, you know, it was hard to believe that they had real buffer overflows left in them. It's just that they couldn't, you know, prove that to the compiler. So the compiler still had a bunch of checks to implement this bounds checking scheme to ensure the safety. Okay. Now, so a question is, something like Python, which never omits this bounds checking, this much slower because it never lets you go out of bounds. So note that there's this range, right? So it depends what kind of code you're writing. So if you're not writing code which needs much bounds checking, well, it's not going to be a big deal. And if we're talking about Python in particular, sort of high-performance Python code usually, for the most part, is basically calling C code to do most of the work, and that's why it's fast. But indeed, if you're doing sort of Python code that does array indexing, this is kind of a limit on how fast it could be if they don't omit that sort of bounds checking, unless they have some clever way of, you know, eliminating the bounds checking when it's not needed. But it seems hard to imagine how Python, which typically uses an interpreter-style implementation, would do that. But I guess I'd note, in the case of thinking about Python's overhead, the sort of interpreter-style implementation that Python typically uses, you know, already adds a ton of overhead. So the bounds checking, you know, is usually not a big deal, relatively speaking. Okay, now, you might say, this is 2002. Have things gotten better since then? Have we figured out better ways of doing this? And, well, yes. So I'm going to go through an example of something that's more efficient than Secret and doesn't require code changes. But it makes some real compromises to achieve this. So this is from a research paper, Baggy Bounds Checking, and advertised in the title as an efficient and backwards compatible defense against out-of-bounds errors. And their idea is that they're not going to use these fat pointers because that changes the calling convention. That's a real big ask, you know, to change how pointers are passed, change the calling convention. So they're going to have a giant lookup table. So you're going to be able to look up where the bounds for any object is based on a pointer to the inside of that object in this lookup table. And the lookup table is going to have one entry for every 16 bytes of memory. You might say, what if we have an object that's smaller than that? Their solution? It's going to be 16 bytes. Sorry. We're just going to allocate some extra space. It's a 16-byte object now. And the table basically is going to let you find the start of the object that's allocated there. So if we think of doing this string index here, we're going to do this check using our lookup table that the start of the string, this is string 0, the thing that the beginning of the string is the same object that we're in if we go I bytes in, that we didn't skip over to another object. And the compiler is going to insert these checks before every single time we dereference a pointer or increment a pointer, I should say. So dereference, increment a pointer, add to a pointer, subtract from a pointer. It's going to make sure that, you know, string plus I must stay within object, within the same object. And the same with string minus I. Any sort of pointer manipulation is going to stay within the same object. That's what we're going to check. We're not actually going to, like, just check the bounds on access. We're going to check it whenever we manipulate a pointer that we don't go to a different object. Now, this idea of having a table of the starting locations, if you compute how big this is, this sounds problematic. So if we're on a 64-bit system, what it seems like we're saying is that for every 16 bytes of memory, I'm going to store an 8-byte pointer. So I'm using 50% more space for my program. And that's an awful lot of extra space. So they're not actually going to store the starting location of objects, but they're going to store a table that is in a much more compact by adding these restrictions. So one restriction they're going to add is that all objects are going to have sizes which are a power of 2. So what this means is that they're going to churn, you know, your buffer of size 100 is going to become a buffer of size 128. You're just going to get some extra space whether you like it or not. And also, objects are going to start at a multiple of their size. So if you have a buffer that was originally size 100, it's now a size 128, and it's going to start at an address that's a multiple of 128. And after doing this, they can store this table much more compactly. The table contains the sort of power of 2, so in this case, 128 is 2 to the 7th, so the table will contain 7, and we'll be able to use these two properties to get where the beginning of the object is with a bit of bitwise operations. Okay. So, questions on the idea of this table lookup? So the question, isn't this something that we were worried about attackers overwriting? So the idea is because we're going to be checking pointer arithmetic here, it's going to be the case that, you know, you have to pass this check to overwrite anything. So hopefully, you know, our bounds checking will prevent attackers from overwriting the table itself, because you know, manipulating a pointer to point to the table would fail this check. As for, you know, if the attacker does overwrite it, what does that let them do? Well, it lets them make bounds checks fail, bounds checks not do what they're supposed to do, but it basically just gets us back to the situation we had before we added this bounds checking. It doesn't, like, contain code pointers itself or anything that's, like, inherently dangerous, you know, if it's overwritten. So if we had this table, so what are we using to do this? Well, we're going to take our objects, which I've marked in this blue. We're going to, like, place them into these power of 2 size slots, and we're going to configure our table to tell us how big each of the objects in the slots are, and it's going to have an entry for every 16 bytes. So, you know, for these 16 bytes, we're saying that's a 16-byte object. This is a 16-byte object, even though part of the object isn't used. Here we have a 32-byte object, so we have two entries in the table saying the thing that's here is 32 bytes. We have to realize that it starts at a multiple of 32 to know it starts here and not here. But we can just do that by doing some pointer manipulation. And similarly here, I have a 64-byte object, and I know the address it starts at because this is going to be a multiple of 2 to the 6, the starting address. And because we're allocating these power of two sizes, we might have to leave some space unused. You know, we're going to be wasting memory. One reason we're going to waste memory is we might have a slot. We could put something in that in order to have, you know, this 64-byte object at a multiple of 64, we couldn't use. And we're also going to have this unused space to make all the sizes powers of two. So this table, it's going to need to be set up. So something has to put values in this table. And there's a question, is this heap memory or stack memory or just stack? So it's going to be both. So malloc and free and new are going to need to set these table entries when they give us memory. So if you call malloc, you know, 40, you know, it might give you this memory here, and it's going to need to set the corresponding table entries to record what it allocated. But we also need to do this for heap allocation, so we need to make the compiler generate code to stack allocation. So we need to make the compiler generate code to do the same thing we were saying, that it needs to say, to allocate this 100-byte buffer, well, we're actually going to allocate 128 bytes. We need to make the stack pointer a multiple of 128 before we allocate the bytes, and we also need to record, you know, in our table that we've allocated 128 bytes. So we have not only the overhead of the space for the table, but we also have this overhead of needing to set the table entries and presumably clear them when we're done, in order to, you know, support making all these pointer checks work. Okay. So the other concern about the table is that we're doing this lookup like this, and this table array seems awfully large. And in particular, if we think about how programs are laid out, you know, we usually have like code and the stack, and, you know, often this is, you know, a huge distance. And it sounds like we're saying that the table needs to be a 16th of this size, which is still, if we start at huge, a 16th of huge is probably still huge. So how do we deal with that? And the trick they use to make that practical is that the table is actually not completely allocated, that they arrange with the OS to only allocate the parts of the table that are in use. The other parts are unallocated memory, which will stack fault, but that's great. So if we try to look up, you know, so if we have a pointer to, you know, what corresponds, so the remember the table sort of corresponds to memory. If we have a pointer that corresponds to this unallocated part, we try to look it up in the table, our program crashes, that's fine. It was out of bounds anyways. And in this way, they're only using, you know, 1/16th overhead for this table rather than having to store these big empty spaces. Of course, now the other part of the overhead is that they actually need to generate every time we access a pointer, the code to like actually do the table lookup before we do, and note that it's pointer arithmetic, and then check, you know, is this in bounds by doing that. So if we were actually doing this check all the time, the performance probably wouldn't be acceptable. But They can do a little better than that. So one example is that they mostly, you know, don't need to protect things that aren't array or pointer accesses. So you aren't, like, doing all relative accesses if it's... And you can, like, do things that, you know, avoid basically cases where the compiler can figure out that this is a safe pointer access. And this is something that's kind of very necessary when we're doing bounds checking, is to try to find places where you don't need to add the code. Now, thinking about sort of what baggy bound, what this bounds checking scheme does. Uh-oh. I meant to have this be an exercise, but apparently I cannot hide answers. How about that? That's interesting. So I was going to ask the poll question, but I've kind of given it away. So let's go through sort of a high-level view of what the overhead is. And the biggest source of overhead, and what I'm sort of pointing out here, is not the space for the table, but that we have to paddle these objects to powers of two. And that means that these 100-byte objects become 128 bytes are stored because we are making it a power of two in order to make the table convenient to store and convenient to do lookups in. And so this means that we have 28 times 1,000, you know, so 28 kilobytes of extra stuff. And this 1,000-byte object, we need to have be, you know, an extra almost 6K of space in order to make it a power of two. And in addition to that, we need space for all the table entries for every 16 bytes here. Now, you might say, can we make adjustments to make this overhead better? So let's think about some adjustments we can make. So one thing you might say is, can we just, you know, not have it be a power of two? Can we have it be something smaller? And we can absolutely do that. But the problem is that we do table lookups doing this nice, cute little bitwise operation here, where we can take a table value, shift it over to get the size. We can do this complement to, you know, get the starting address by clearing the lower bits of the object. And that's all possible because we're using power of two sizes and storing values at multiples of powers of two. You know, sort of our trick is to clear the lower bits of the pointer. So that's not really something that, you know, we can do if we decide to use non-powers of two sizes. We can use the same kind of strategy, but this calculation gets a lot more complicated. And problematically, we're doing this all the time. So we can save space, but we're going to have trouble saving... actual sort of, you know, usable performance, because, you know, when we make it more space compact, the performance overhead is going to get a lot worse. So sort of another example here, let's we talked about space overhead. Let's talk about sort of, here's a string cat. How many bounds checks do we need to implement this with something like baggy bounds checking? Okay. And a question about what I was talking about previously, how do we use the size to get the address? So I'll use it with this example. So here, let's say S points to you know, the middle of a buffer that is this big. If this buffer is, say, 256, which is 2 to the 8 characters, with baggy bounds checking, we know that this is, you know, 2 to the 8th times some value, and we'll look up in the table that that's true, and if it's 2 to the 8th has some value, this means that the last 8 bits of the address at the beginning of the buffer are 0. And because of that, if we just set the last 8 bits to 0 here, we're going to get up to the beginning of the buffer, assuming memory grows downwards. And I guess, well, okay. So I'll give another 10 seconds or so. Okay. So we have, so on the number of bounce checks, if we, assuming we don't optimize them away, we have sort of a split between one or more than one. So someone wanted to defend more than one. Why would there be more than one per character of S? Since more than half of you answered that.
So it seems like, yeah, as someone just put it in the chat, but it seems like you have to check and make sure that the place you're trying to index in S is allowed, and also the place you're trying to place it in D is also within bounds.
Yeah, so yes, one way of thinking about it is that we have two different accesses using index to different things. We can't share the bounds check between them. They have to be different bounds checks. So I would say it's sort of about 2 per character. And maybe arguably 3 per character, if we're being really naive, because we have 1, 2, 3. As for the number of instructions that this loop would be, well, you know, so this depends on sort of what sort of assembly language we're thinking about. But sort of the way I think about it is that, like, basically this loop is going to be a compare, a move to do the copy, and an add to do the plus one. You know, so this is like about a 4 instruction loop that runs once per character of S. So questions about the conclusions I made here? So we have like 2 or 3, depending on whether you think these 2 bounds checks are the same. Bounds checks per character of S, you know, some of them aren't for S, but, you know, it's total work we have to do. And, you know, before the bounds checking, we had like 4 instructions for the loop. The reason I like mentioned the number of instructions is that we looked at sort of the code we were adding to do the bounds checking. And it's like 7 instructions. So if we're adding 3 times 7 instructions, that's, we're writing 21 instructions to this loop. That's has like 4 to 6-ish. Yeah. So that's, you know, where we get concerned about the cost of this bounce checking. And sort of in practice, often what you might end up doing is you might sort of have a special version of functions like stringcat that's sort of more optimized but does bounce checking. So question is, why don't we just have the compiler warn that you aren't doing bounce checking? So it's hard for the compiler to automatically know that you are or are not doing enough bounce checking. And I guess more of a concern is that sort of the goal that these solutions are usually coming up with is that I want to take some existing C code I have lying around and run it safely. That it's not going to be acceptable for me to say, sorry, that C program you've been running for 10 years, don't run it anymore. It might be unsafe. You know, that's not going to be an answer that someone wants to hear if they're using our tool. Okay. Now, one thing that was kind of inconvenient about this baggy bounds checking idea is that we had to store this big lookup table. On a 64-bit system, there's this clever idea that they implemented, which avoids that lookup table. So we save a bunch of space overhead. So we just have to worry about the padding. Now, the padding is a lot of the space, but it's a really clever trick. And what they said is, well, on a 64-bit system, we can't actually use all the bits of the pointer usefully. So they just said, we're going to use some bits of the pointer to store the information that would have been in the lookup table anyways. And to get at this, we're just going to do some bitwise operations. When we want to use the pointer, normally we'll just do a bitwise operation to zero out these bits. And so this gets rid of that table. And you just like set up these the size bits of the pointer when you allocate something, you know. And when you know what that size is. And this, again, this size is, remember, you know, this is which power of 2. So this idea is commonly known as pointer tagging, the general idea of putting information in your pointers is known as pointer tagging, and it actually comes up in a whole bunch of other places when you're talking about doing tricks to, you know, get high performance for, you know, adding information to C or assembly. Question that still has padding cost? Yes. So we're still doing all the same padding. We've just removed the table overhead. Okay. So you might say, how well did this scheme do? And, you know, like with most of these bounce checking schemes we've seen, it depends on your program. So they ran a whole bunch of benchmarks, and they found their time overhead was from 4 to 72%. So some programs was pretty cheap. Other programs, it was super slow. I mean, not super slow, but 72% time overhead. It's going to be hard to convince someone, you know, your program's going to take 72% more time. And the space overhead with a table and not tagged pointers was about 10 to 20%, including all the padding stuff. So not horrible, but you know, that's a hard case to make. You know, it's like your web server's you're gonna need, you know, 15% more memory to run your web server. I don't know if you'll convince people that, you know, that's worthwhile all the time. And notably, there's some things that this baggy bounds checking scheme doesn't deal with that sort of our previous scheme did. And one of these things is that when we have like pointers within objects, you know, well, we want to set some bounds for that. So let's say here I get a pointer to, you know, this array of struct foos to the middle of one of the buffers. And question is, what are the bounds here? And if we're thinking about our fat pointer scheme, we would want the bounds to be probably buffer 0 to, you know, buffer 1024. But baggy bounds can't do this because from their perspective, we have the array of foos object, and that's what we're going to have our bounds be. So this bounds checking idea is also kind of incomplete. It checks bounds if you're going outside of a heap or a stack object, but when we have these different parts of the same object, well, there's only one size number for each part of memory, and that's going to have to be most likely, you know, if this array, if we're checking the array of foos, it's going to be for the array of foos, not for the things inside it. And we need to have some considerably more complicated scheme to, like, store those, like, that idea of multiple different bounds. Or maybe, like, do some transformation where, like, we change how this struct is represented to, like, have a pointer to something allocated elsewhere. You know, it's just actually a very tricky problem for us to solve with this style of scheme. And as we've sort of seen with the subterfuge assignment, this is a big problem when this sort of thing happens. You know, and it's probably going to get us in trouble. So another thing about the bounds check baggy bounds scheme, which was a problem they did solve, but is kind of an annoyance, is that they wanted to do checking when you created a pointer here. So here we aren't actually, so here, note we, you know, not dereferencing anything yet. Yeah. But they did a, you know, so baggy bounds, they decided, you know, bounds checks here. So they do the bounds checking not when you dereference a pointer, but when you make a pointer pointing to one part of an object point to a different part of an object. So this does a bounds check, and you know, if we did something like p plus 10,000, that would do another bounds check. And so the problem why, so there's a question of like, isn't this bounds checked? Yeah, this is bounds checked. But the problem is that when we take this pointer and manipulate it, well, the bounds to see if like this is okay, we're going to say, yes, we're going within the same object. It's fine, which is not what we wanted. But something worth noting is that we're doing these bounds checks on chain, making new pointers. And some C code tries to deliberately make pointers go outside of objects. So, for example, let's say I have an array here, and it has a size of size. So here's some code which where they decided that they wanted to start arrays at 1. They really wish C started arrays at 1. So what they're going to do is they're going to make array point deliberately out of bounds. But that's okay because they're going to start accessing array of 1 up to and including array of size. And this is correct C code. Well, this is not technically correct C code, but this is a common thing that people do. In particular, this code here is generated by a program called F2C that people really do use, which translates from Fortran to C. And so this is a case where baggy bounds gets in trouble for a completely different reason. So here, the issue isn't that we're not checking some sort of bounds. The issue is that we're checking whether this modified array pointer is still in bounds, even though it doesn't actually matter at this point. So we have a case here where we don't check, we don't know the bounds on this even though it would matter. Here, we check that this is in bounds of the array, even though it doesn't matter. Because Baggy Bounds wants to see, you know, that this is okay. And what the Baggy Bounds people did is that they had a special case for accesses like this, where they would stash what object this pointer came from just in order to make this code still work. And they needed to do that because there were enough programs out there that were broken if you didn't allow this out-of-bounds pointer. Okay. So questions about Baggy Bounds. So the question is, why not only check on dereference? So the issue with only checking on dereference is once we get a pointer to here, if we do a table lookup, we're going to find out that it's in the previous object. And we would want to be trying to determine whether it's in this object versus this one. So we need to... And that would not enforce the bounds correctly. So we need to actually check that we're not changing objects with this change in order to enforce the bounds. So the solution that the paper used is that they said, okay, we're going to notice that we change objects, but we're not going to crash the program as a result. We're going to store the information to say, oh, we have a pointer in this object, but really it should only be used to access the following object, and have a special case for that. Does that answer the question? Okay. So... Baggy Bounds, so this was a pretty influential paper, even if, you know, it's not really something I've seen anyone ever use. Now, but there are some schemes which you may have used. So, for example, if you've taken 3330 or 4414 with me, I've occasionally, I guess, more 4414, shrewd assignments which use address sanitizer, which is a memory error detector. And it's practical. It's built into compilers. In GCC and Clang, if you compile and link with fsanitize equals address, it does bounds checking. And it, from a high level, looks kind of like baggy bounds checking, but it has some important differences. So like baggy bounds checking, it has this big lookup table. Now, the big lookup table for address sanitizer doesn't contain sizes. It just contains yes, no, basically. And, you know, it's set by memory allocator, so it changes how stack allocations work, it changes how heap allocations work in order to populate that lookup table. So those ideas are the same. So unlike baggy bounds, so it doesn't check those pointer calculations. So the way address sanitizer deals with this is that it only checks this access here. But a consequence of that is that address sanitizer doesn't detect errors except if you're writing in space between objects. And so what I mean by that is that, you know, if we have another object here, and you end up writing to it using this R pointer, it's going to say, that's fine. Or sort of more notably, if we have, you know, an offset that's like really big passed to this function, you know, if it happens to land on usable memory, it's going to pass. Because what address sanitizer is going to do is it's going to say, let's compute the new address that we're dereferencing. Is it a valid address? That's all it's checking. So that means that it doesn't actually deal with security issues in a great way. Like, it solves some problems, but because this check is just, did we end up with an address that's in an object, what we rely on is that there's some space that's invalid in between objects. So address sanitizer solution is that they're going to add what they call a red zone after the array, and their hope is that your offset is going to land in that red zone. That, you know, you're going to try to access array of 10 or array of 11, not like, you know, array of 0x13. Because if you access array of 0x13, they're going to say, okay, that's normal. You know, or array of 0x12, they're going to say, that's normal, that's allocated memory. Because there's going to be a lookup table, so on. The question is, this seems similar to canaries? Yeah, so the effect of what they're checking for is like stack canaries, that they can deal with sort of direct overflows of buffers. And they can do this for things on the heap too, but they're not going to actually detect, you know, every sort of out of bounds access. So it's a lot more efficient and more practical than baggy bounds, but it doesn't actually solve that sort of security problem. So the question is, couldn't we have done this with guard pages? You absolutely could have, but by using this lookup table idea, we can use a lot less space. Other questions? Okay, so this is where, since I'm out of time, I'll finish up talking about address sanitizer briefly next time, and then we'll start talking about a bit about testing. And there was a question earlier about, am I going to talk about sort of exploits and things like Java? So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about sort of exploits that come up in a bunch of places. I'm under the impression that some of the more common types, like SQL injection-like things, you go over in prior classes. So I would need, like, I'm not sure I have, like, a big level of detail for most of them, but I think there's some specific topics on sort of that sort of exploit that still occurs in memory safe languages that we'll talk about briefly.